You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
It is, or I guess it will be when it exists, almost exactly as far as you can go in Canada, while still being technically in Canada. It will be huge, absolutely enormous, really. And it will accomplish things never before attempted by other projects like it. Depending on who you talk to about the Bay du Nord project, it will either save Newfoundland's economy and usher in a new era of prosperity in the province, or it will be the kind of disaster that could endanger the fishing industry, contribute to destroying the environment, and hasten the onset of the climate crisis. And actually, to a lot of people, it will be all of those things, good and bad. So what is it? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Lindsay Bourgon is a writer, researcher, oral historian, and the author of a book called Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. She wrote about the Bay du Nord project for Maclean's. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure, and I'm going to start just by situating us for those who aren't familiar with the East Coast, or the way, way East Coast, I guess. What is the Flemish Pass? Why is it so important?
Yeah, it's a good question, and your framing there is way, way East Coast is very good because it's right on the edge of the Canadian boundaries, nautical boundaries. So the Flemish Pass is located about 500 kilometers north-northeast from St. John's into the North Atlantic, and it's about 1/6 of the way to Ireland. Mm. What it is a deep basin, and under which lies about 500 million barrels of light crude oil. It's a very sort of harsh, extreme nautical environment. You're way out to sea. If you ever see pictures of it, it looks like you're in the middle of the ocean because you almost are.
So I mentioned this is about the Bay du Nord offshore oil project. Beyond just an offshore oil project, what is it? Who's behind it? How important is it?
Sure. So Bay du Nord is a $16 billion offshore oil project. It's majority owned by Equinor, but BP holds a smaller stake as well. And what it is, it's a pretty ambitious offshore oil undertaking. Bay du Nord was first discovered in 2013 by Equinor. And since then, it's been going through the various levels of sort of exploration, discovery, and then plans for development. So the expectations for it are pretty big. Newfoundland's provincial government estimates that it could create more than $14 billion in economic activity and provide $3.5 billion in government revenues. So another big part of this project is that the province of Newfoundland and Labrador is thinking that it will establish the province as a sort of deep water drilling center of excellence, and that the sort of future of offshore oil is really encapsulated through Bay du Nord and through the work that will come through Newfoundland for it.
You described it as a very ambitious project. Why is it so ambitious? What will this project be like when it's finished? And what's different, I guess, from other, deep water mining, offshore oil extraction? Like, what's special?
Yeah. So what really sets it apart is that it's further out to sea than any other project in Newfoundland or Canadian offshore oil history has ever drilled.
What kind of problems does that pose?
Yeah, I mean, it poses all sorts of challenges, engineering challenges and environmental challenges. So the project will be about 40 wells that will be drilled just over 1,000 meters below the waves. And so it's almost 10 times the depth of the second deepest project.
Wow.
So it's sort of a huge jump forward in the science and in the engineering of offshore work, at least in Canada. And so, yeah, it requires, drilling very deep into the seabed, workers that will be connecting pipes, that kind of absolutely massive 30-foot long 600-pound pipes that will descend all the way through the ocean and into the ocean floor. And then it will extract light crude and send it up to the production facility above. And so that, you know, your listeners might have a sense of kind of what an offshore oil rig looks like. It's a floating platform in the middle of the ocean. People that are working on it live on the platform. They are helicoptered in, as are their supplies, and they're working through Atlantic weather to set up this project and to continue it until it shuts down, which is expected to be, I think, once it's up and running, it'll have a 10-year lifespan. So it's a massive operation.
Before we get into the pros and cons, and I guess I want to know about the risks of going 10 times deeper than the previous deepest well, we'll talk about that. But in terms of Newfoundland and its people and its economy, how big is this for them? What's at stake here?
Yeah, so I think in Canadian history, a lot of us have this kind of idea of Newfoundland as being quite remote and often sort of struggling with the boom and bust economy and its history of sort of the cod moratorium and the ups and downs of mining and fisheries. Mm-hmm. And so Bay du Nord is framed in that context, and it comes in and it provides a sort of 21st century foundation for a really steady economy through royalty payments and through work provided to Newfoundland and Labrador residents that otherwise isn't there. It's interesting. I mean, in 2018, the province said that they were going to double oil production within 10 years. Their politicians have certainly, the majority of them have really adopted this idea that oil and gas, particularly, I suppose, what they're framing as green oil and gas, is really important for the province's future. But as you can imagine, that's up for debate. I mean, the work that's being done has been estimated that, you know, there's going to be 22 million work hours provided through this project to Newfoundland and Labrador residents. And that's really hard to ignore. So it, you know, it really provides the towns, a lot of these kind of small former fishery towns and now sort of peninsula towns that might work in manufacturing or provide other sorts of services. It provides an incoming revenue stream for a lot of the people that work there. And it also provides an opportunity for folks that live in Newfoundland to stay home to work, which is a really big part of this story. So I think there's a sort of stereotype, particularly in the West, that people from Newfoundland need to leave Newfoundland to work. And Bay du Nord counters that. You know, it would provide an opportunity for a lot of people to stay home with their families and not do shift work going back and forth from Alberta or other mining projects in other parts of the country, or even kind of other jobs in other parts of the country, that it would provide a fair, stable income and allow you to be at home, which a lot of people have felt was not in their future as Newfoundlanders and Labradorians.
That's the positive side. And I think everybody wants what's best for Newfoundland's economy and for jobs in the province and for people not to have to leave. This is not a popular time to be digging gigantic deep oil wells. What does Equinor say about environmental concerns around this project? You know, it's a gigantic new fossil fuels endeavor. Surely they faced a lot of criticism.
Yeah, they have. And the approvals process has been long and drawn out for it.
How do they defend it? Before we get into like the poking holes and the actual risks, how do they defend it?
Yeah, so Equinor, they've really banked on this kind of imagery they have around their work that they are the friendly oil and gas company, and that, you know, and part of that is that they are owned by the Norwegian government. They're seen as being sort of a little bit more ethical. They say that extracting a barrel of oil from Bay du Nord, you know, will only produce about 8 kilograms of carbon dioxide, for instance, which is far less than the amount that's produced coming out of the Alberta oil sands, which, you know, some companies have estimated that the footprint of that oil is 100 kilograms per barrel. And so that is a big part of how Equinor sort of justifies continuing to do this work. And then on top of that, you know, they conducted an environmental impact assessment, and they've kind of followed through on all of the requirements of the federal and the provincial governments to think about the environmental impacts. They've also, you know, we can talk a little bit about this later, but when the project was approved, it was approved with over 100 conditions. And so a condition of the approval, one of these 137 conditions that were kind of attached to the approval of the project, is that not that it will be carbon neutral, but that it will achieve net zero status by 2050. So basically requiring that all the greenhouse gases produced in the operations and in the work will have to be offset by carbon capture technologies or other ways by 2050. So that's also a big part of how the project is kind of framing itself as not as bad, essentially, as other oil and gas projects.
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you about this is because, you know, you are really trying in your piece to balance the economic necessities with the environmental costs. And we've done a good job of that so far, I think, painting aside from each of it. But I will tell you that when I read that piece and I think about this, and especially when I see like biggest, deepest, hugest, et cetera, all I can think about is what happens if something goes wrong, if it's going that deep and there's that much, like there's a disaster movie scenario here, right? What is it?
Well, there's quite a few ways that things can go wrong. You know, there are... Oh, there's unpredictable conditions at sea. There could, you know, that could lead to chemical spills, for instance, or leaks or blowouts. Newfoundland has a pretty strong history of disaster happening, actually, around oil and gas offshore. So there was the Sea Rose project in 2018. It spilled just over 200,000 liters of oil into the Atlantic. There's the Cougar helicopter flight crash where offshore workers were being helicoptered to the platform to take work and the helicopter crashed. And then, of course, there is the Ocean Ranger disaster in 1982, where bad weather essentially crept up really quickly on the Ocean Ranger mobile oil platform in the Grand Banks area, which is, you know, just a slight amount closer to Newfoundland than Bay du Nord. And the lifeboats capsized and all 84 crew members died. And then there are environmental disasters. So, you know, a blowout can impact the fisheries, you know, in Newfoundland and PEI and Labrador, for instance, and it can really impact sort of far down the food chain, the ecosystems and the output of marine life. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got birds and other marine life that are going to have to change their migratory route to go around the project, and that are impacted by things like even air pollution and sound. Underwater sound really impacts the breeding grounds of all sorts of fisheries that impact all sorts of animals down the line. And that doesn't even really take into account the environmental risks that come from climate change, you know, either upstream in the production of this oil and gas that's being extracted, but also downstream. And so it, you know, there are 3-4 levels of ways that there could be damage caused and risk kind of out of control.
So I'm not trying to be a spoil sport with all this, but then why was it approved? I understand the people of Newfoundland would want it, and you mentioned the provincial government was for it. This must have had to go further up the chain. And what was that process like?
Yeah, so it was quite a long process. I mean, from 2018 to 2020, the Impact Assessment Agency of Canada, which is under the Environment and Climate Change Canada Department, looked through a submission, an EIA environmental impact submission from Equinor, and returned to the company 2 years later asking for more information, which they did. And then from there, they welcomed public submissions. You know, in the meantime, the federal government kind of continued to delay the decision, continued to delay. There was lobbying during this point from trade unions and environmental groups and kind of everyone getting their opinions in on what Bay du Nord could mean. There were rallies all throughout this time, and really the government was the federal government, which did give the kind of final decision on Bay du Nord, was considering the balance between risk and the work that Equinor had done to show that they understood that risk and that they had mitigations in place versus the economic and cultural risk that had been kind of laid out. And so when it was approved, which was April 2022, last April, you know, it did come with 137 binding conditions. And so that was a lot. And the kind of justification given to that is that the government was wanting to see that there would be work done on Equinor's front to address the climate concerns in particular. So, you know, you've got the net zero requirement in there. Not very long after, the same department did not approve an additional Suncor oil sands development in Alberta. And, you know, I think the argument between these two is that the Bay du Nord project is downstream and upstream releasing less carbon dioxide, less into the air than oil sands work. And so that was how that came about, not without much name calling. I mean, Minister Stephen Guilbeault, before he had this job and, you know, before he had entered politics, they called him Green Jesus of Montreal. He has a history of environmental activism, and you know, he was co-founder of the group Équiterre. He climbed the CN Tower to protest climate change, you know, many years ago. And yet here we are. And so I think for many it was a pretty stark showing of hypocrisy. Right. But for Guilbeault, I think, you know, the way that the department has framed this decision is that he took everything into account and decided that this was a sort of innovative project that would allow for extraction to take place with environmental concerns in mind.
And that's fair enough. I mean, we've spoken about the economic necessity versus the environmental concerns. But I want to ask, before we're done, a bit of a bigger picture question. You kind of touched on it when we talked about the practical risks of climate change. When you talk to people in Newfoundland, how do they wrestle with the economic need to keep the province, you know, on solid financial ground and the increasing reality of just climate change that they're seeing around them? Like, this is a province that is going to feel the brunt of the climate era that's already seen worse storms, more unpredictable weather. So I'm not asking, you know, barrels in, carbon out, et cetera, just more of like an existential thing. You know, this is a huge project and this is the reality.
Yeah. And this is a type of thorny part of the culture that I really like to get into. And, you know, I've found reporting on Bay du Nord and then also on other topics of extraction, you know, I think it would be a disservice to kind of frame it, not that you are, but to sort of frame it that anyone who works in the industry just thinks that it should always be development over everything else and that, you know, there's no sort of care about climate change or over extraction or boom and bust cycles. You know, people that I was interviewing, they were saying to me, like, we know that we need to transition away from this cycle. We want to. Nobody actually wants to work in a boom and bust economy. Right. You know, like, I don't think that anybody really wants to ever feel the rug pulled from underneath them, let alone kind of regularly every 2 to 5 years kind of thing. But at the same time, they were saying, you know, by approving Bay du Nord, it will give us that time to prepare for any sort of just transition that we think needs to come next. Maybe this should be the last one. And, you know, there was a real reliance in industry and in people that work offshore in talking to me and saying, like, there are these conditions and there is the sort of net zero requirement that's attached to this thing. And what else could we ask for at this point but to do this work and do it safely and well and hope that it gives us space to transition 10 years down the line as opposed to denying it now and not having anything in its place. I mean, that's a nice thought. I agree with it. Everyone would agree with it, right? Like mm-hmm. on this level, environmentalists and workers and people that work in politics, for instance, in policy, I think they would all agree. It's just that the trust on the environmentalist side that that will actually happen.
Right.
And the concern on the workers' side that there will be actually fair paying jobs on the other end, they can be at odds. And so what ends up happening is that there's calls just to stop all drilling, no new projects, and people get their backs up about that.
Last question then, if this is going forward, what does that actually mean in terms of time? What gets built now? When will When will the first barrel of quote unquote clean oil come up from there?
I don't know. And I don't know that anyone knows for sure at this point. So the federal government gave its approval, but there are still some negotiations happening between the province and Equinor in terms of how much manufacturing will actually take place in Newfoundland versus how much will actually be shipped in from elsewhere and essentially just be geographically arriving in St. John's Harbor and then leaving right away. I think that this is actually a really interesting component of the story. It's, you know, a lot of the work is still outsourced and is still kind of being done in other markets and then arriving at ports in Newfoundland and then being shipped out right away. When you actually have the capacity, or you could have the capacity to do manufacturing in Newfoundland itself and have it leave from there. So it's this huge globalized industry, and they're really getting down to that nitty-gritty now of what the company can ensure happens in Newfoundland aside from simply being located off of it.
Lindsay, thank you so much for this. It's a great piece.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Lindsay Borgon, writing in Maclean's. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You know by now you can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, and you can call us 416-935-5935 and leave us a voice message, good or bad. You can also email us with story ideas. This was actually a story idea that was emailed from a listener, although they didn't leave their name, so I have no idea who it was. But if it was you and you were curious about this project, now you know a little more. That email address is hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.